Welcome back to La Belle Vie. Now that Charlie Adelson has been convicted in the murder of his former brother-in-law, FSU law professor Dan Markell, and Donna Adelson, Charlie and Wendy Adelson's mother, has been indicted for the same charges, we're all wondering if Wendy Adelson is going to be the next charge in some crime. Now, a major question that has arisen regarding Wendy's situation involves the use and derivative use immunity that she was provided under the state subpoenas compelling her testimony in the three Markell trials. Specifically, there have been questions on the U.S. Supreme Court case Castigar. So today we're going to dive into Castigar, use and derivative use immunity under Florida law, and how this relates to Wendy's prior testimony and any potential new charges. Now, before we begin, I want to stress that Wendy Adelson has not been charged with any crime and is presumed innocent unless proven guilty in a court of law. In addition, this video is not legal advice, but rather is a general commentary on the issues. I encourage everyone to do their own research. Okay, Castigar. Castigar is a U.S. Supreme Court case that holds that the government can compel testimony from an unwilling witness who invokes the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, provided it confers upon that witness use and derivative use immunity. Put another way, the Supreme Court in Castigar held that providing use and derivative use immunity is coextensive or equivalent to the scope of protection. Now, what does use and derivative use immunity mean? Use and derivative use immunity means that the compelled testimony and evidence derived from such compelled testimony cannot be used in a subsequent criminal proceeding. So, first, Wendy's testimony in the three trials where she received immunity can't be used if she's charged. That's the use part. The battle is going to be about whether the state's evidence is derived from Wendy's compelled testimony. Now, if Wendy were to be charged, I presume the defense will try to argue that incriminating evidence against her is derived from her testimony. And under Castigar, a person raising an immunity claim need only show that he or she testified under that grant of immunity in order to shift the burden to the government to prove that the other evidence it proposes to use is derived from a legitimate source wholly independent from the compelled testimony. That's done in what is commonly referred to as a Castigar hearing. Also, it's important to understand that for U.S. constitutional purposes, per Castigar, only use and derivative use immunity is required. The U.S. Constitution does not require what's called transactional immunity, which is broader. Transactional immunity provides immunity from prosecution for offenses to which the compelled testimony relates, period. It's also known as blanket immunity. Now, no doubt, due to the Castigar burden, any prosecution against Wendy is going to be more difficult and more litigious. But remember, as Castigar instructs us, use and derivative use immunity statutes, like the Fifth Amendment itself, grant neither pardon nor amnesty. Both allow the government to prosecute using evidence from legitimate independent sources. So let's now turn to Florida law. Now, taking a step back, a state can provide greater protections than what the U.S. Constitution requires. And again, Castigar informs us that the U.S. constitutional standard is just use and derivative use immunity. It doesn't require that broader transactional blanket immunity. But Florida or any other state can choose to provide greater protection than what the U.S. Constitution requires. Now, Florida's statute, which is 91404, which I'm showing here, provides use and derivative use immunity. So you'll see here, this is the section 914.04, witnesses, persons not excused from testifying or producing evidence in certain prosecutions on ground testimony might criminate him or her. Use of testimony given or evidence produced. Now you'll see here in the statute that if a person has received a subpoena to attend and testify or produce evidence in any court having felony trial jurisdiction, grand jury, or state attorney upon investigation, proceeding, or trial for a violation of any of the criminal statutes in the state, then no testimony so given or evidence so produced shall be received against the person upon any criminal investigation. However, such evidence or testimony may be received against the person upon any criminal investigation or proceeding for perjury. Now, this statute tracks a lot of the federal statutes, but essentially it's use and derivative use immunity, not transactional immunity. Now, just a tidbit, before 914.04 was amended in 1982, it did provide that broader transactional immunity. Now, since 1982, when this was amended, Florida is a use and derivative use immunity state, consistent with Castigar. So let's now turn to Wendy. What I did was I reviewed her testimony from all three trials. I know, it was a lot. And I reviewed not just her direct testimony, but her cross-examination. And I did that to first identify areas of her prior testimony that relate to potentially incriminating evidence that may be used against her. And then I took some of those areas, and for each of them, I thought about what evidence that we know of that the state has that is derived from a legitimate source wholly independent of Wendy's testimony. Again, the Castigar rule. Oh, and before we get to that, recall that Wendy's use and derivative use immunity applies to her trial testimony under state subpoena and any evidence derived from those testimonies. It doesn't apply to Wendy's police interview that took place on the day Dan was murdered on July 18th, 2014, more than 5 years before Wendy's first trial testimony on September 27th, 2019. Recall in Charlie's trial, Georgia had a transcript of that police interview, which she referenced to several times during Wendy's direct examination. For example, Georgia asked Wendy about her mentioning Charlie as someone who could have done this early on in the police interview. And Wendy asked to look at the transcript. Wendy's response was, "Well, this is the transcript, but I think that there's also inaccuracies in the transcription." You think there's going to be a legal battle there? Also, I keep getting this weird vibe with Wendy repeatedly saying she spent 8 hours with the police, which was really about 5 hours. And she said it was without representation, how she handed over her phone, her laptop, let them search her car. And Rashbaum even brought this up too in his cross of Wendy, how her lunch was interrupted by Detective Isom. She went with him voluntarily. She let police search her car. She was interviewed from 2:45 to 7:50 p.m. Then he said to her, "You were pretty open with police." And Wendy said, "Well, they kept telling me that they needed my help, so I was trying to help." Then Rashbaum continues, "You agreed to let police search your phone. You agreed to let police search your car. You agreed to be fingerprinted. You agreed to be checked for gunshot residue. You gave them your computer to be searched." I wouldn't be surprised if we see some legal battles on Wendy's police interview, should she ever be charged. Okay, so the three motives that I thought of were one, relocate to South Florida and finally be done with Tally. Freedom to parent the children without complications from Dan, such as education, religion, diet, communication, recreational activities, and visitation. And the third motive is to end the threat of being sanctioned, disciplined by the bar, losing her job, or reputation. Now, the other area that I looked at initially was what trial testimony is there that relates to her potential involvement in the murder for hire itself. Okay, let's start with motive. Number one, relocate to South Florida and finally be done with Tally. Okay, so let's tick through the evidence we know regarding relocation and how it pertains to Wendy. Now, first, we have the relocation petition and the related proceedings from the divorce itself. The documents, they speak for themselves. I don't think there's going to be any argument that those documents are not independent evidence. Okay, number two. We have Donna's emails relating to relocation, which were presumably downloaded from Wendy's phone during the police interview on the day of Dan's murder. Also, the state's first discovery response in 2016 includes as tangible evidence Wendy's Gmail and FSU email accounts. So these should be independent from Wendy's trial testimony since they took place much earlier. We also have Jeffrey Lacasse, who can testify how much Wendy hated Tallahassee and how much she wanted to be back in South Florida. Jeff provided three separate police interviews, the first within days of Dan's murder. On that basis, the state should not have an issue proving that that evidence relating to Jeff's police interviews was derived from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's testimony. Now, what about emails or texts we haven't seen yet? Again, we have to ask ourselves, what's the Castigar rule? Were they obtained from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's compelled trial testimony? I think here, if any previously unseen emails or texts came from her phone or the other records that the state obtained way before her first trial testimony, I don't think there's going to be a problem. The only thing I can think of is if the state discovered emails or texts after one of her trial testimonies, then that could be an issue. So for example, if something she said, maybe in the first trial triggered a follow-up investigation, and then that led to discovery of a new email or a text that the state didn't have before, then I think you've got a Castigar problem. Now, Wendy's trial testimony on the relocation itself, again, the state can't use that. That's the use in use immunity. But much of it is, in my opinion, self-serving anyway. Things like she was relieved when the petition was denied. She didn't think there was a real chance of it being successful. Danny was potentially okay with relocation if he could live nearby and commute to FSU. Danny never planned on staying in Tallahassee. It was a stopping point. Wendy didn't agree with the $1 million bribe, and it wasn't offered because she didn't want to do it. She denied relocation was the most important part of her divorce. She said it was more important to Donna, looking forward to having her daughter home and the grandchildren at home. So I don't think the state's going to want to use any of that, right? That's pro-Wendy. Now, Wendy did testify that she wanted a place of permanence where she had family support, and that was in South Florida. And she also said she had a lot more career opportunities in South Florida. So that would go towards motive that those are reasons she would want to relocate. But the prosecution has independent evidence of that in her own relocation pleadings. I mean, she said most of that in her petition to relocate. So I just don't see this aspect of motive relocation being an issue for the state should they decide to bring charges. Okay, motive number two, freedom to parent the children without complications from Dan, such as education, religion and diet, communications, recreational activities, and visitation. Now, first, we have the divorce litigation, and in particular, the post-divorce motions, and specifically, Dan's counter-motion to enforce the marital settlement agreement on parenting issues, the grandma motion. Again, these pleadings are all independent of Wendy's testimony. Next, we have emails and texts between Wendy and Donna and Charlie. And we've seen a lot of these emails and texts regarding Wendy's parenting issues with Dan, such as conflicts at one of the child's birthday parties, soccer practice, the kids' school, how often they talk on Skype. Now, assuming these emails, again, were all part of the initial police investigation and not discovered after one of those trial testimonies, again, I don't see an immunity Castigar issue here. We also have Jeffrey Lacasse, who was very aware of Wendy's co-parenting relationship with Dan, particularly in the months leading up to Dan's murder. He also knows how much the post-divorce litigation affected her. We also have Stephen Webster, who was Dan's divorce attorney at the time of Dan's murder. Stephen was listed as a witness in the state's first discovery response in 2016. So it's doubtful that his testimony would be precluded for derivative use. It is likely that law enforcement spoke with him very early on in the investigation when it became clear that the divorce and post-divorce litigation was a strong indicator of motive. And recall, Stephen provided powerful testimony on the serious concerns Dan was having with Wendy at the time of his murder on co-parenting, including Donna's alleged interference and Wendy's alleged failure to consult with Dan on education matters, namely their oldest child's school, in the imminent weeks ahead. There are probably also emails and texts we haven't seen yet. So it's the same issue. The state will need to show that this evidence was derived from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's compelled testimony. So again, if the state already had this information before Wendy took the stand, again, I don't see how this is a derivative use issue. Now, like relocation, Wendy's trial testimony on parenting issues, the state can't use it. That's use. But also, just like we saw with relocation, most of Wendy's testimony on this issue is self-serving. For example, she didn't remember specifics about the grandma motion, but she knew that Dan was frustrated with Skyping. Well, that's not news. We already saw that covered in a number of the divorce pleadings and the post-divorce litigation. She didn't immediately recall Dan's allegations regarding Donna, but she said he made a lot of allegations that weren't true. Another thing she testified to was no one, including herself or Donna, took the threat that Donna may be stuck with supervised visitation seriously. Another part of her testimony as evidence that, you know, Donna didn't take the grandma motion seriously was that Danny asked her parents to babysit the kids shortly after he filed that motion, and Donna even made him banana bread. Another part of her testimony on this issue was regarding the name change, and she said that was done for safety reasons and that the dropping of the oldest child's middle name was her losing an honor to both families. Again, that seems pretty self-serving. And as we saw in Charlie's trial, the state will be able to offer Wendy's emails forwarding the grandma motion to 12 people. And then on the name change, the state has the official record, which establishes the date that the name was changed. And then as to the email Wendy sent to the Markells months after she legally changed their names, that again is likely part of the evidence the state had early on and prior to any of Wendy's testimonies. Now, she did testify that being kosher wasn't important to her, but it was for Danny, and that their divorce was partly due to differing views on religion and how the children should be raised. Her testimony would not be allowed under, again, the use immunity. However, the state should be able to cite to other evidence from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's testimony to speak to these issues about the parenting issues on the religion. Another motive is resolving this impending threat of being sanctioned, having disciplinary actions taken against her regarding her law license and potential reputational loss. You could add financial here, although I personally don't think the financial motive for Wendy is as strong as maybe some of these other motives, but there's certainly evidence on the financial part too. So on the threat of sanctions, disciplinary actions, and reputational loss, we have all the divorce pleadings, and specifically on this issue, Dan's motion to enforce the marital settlement agreement on financial issues. We also have the testimony from Stephen Webster. You recall he testified that in his view, there was a real threat to Wendy relating to Dan's counter motion that remained undecided as of his murder. Now, assuming that law enforcement spoke with Stephen early on, there shouldn't be a derivative use issue. And like the other motives we discussed, there could be emails and texts we haven't seen. You know, there might be witnesses we don't know, right? In prior trials. Because if they're ever going to charge Wendy, as we saw with Charlie, there's going to be different people that come into play, different focus on different emails, different focus on different witnesses. We just don't know what the state has. Now, as far as Wendy's testimony on this motive, again, it can't be used because of use immunity. But not surprising again, in my opinion, it's pretty self-serving anyway. You know, what she testified to was she wasn't concerned about being disbarred. The Dan's financial accusations were completely baseless. She thought she'd prevail against Dan's counter motion on the financial issues. Her attorney didn't take these allegations seriously. Dan created a hostile work environment for her at FSU when he said she had mental issues. Now, I don't foresee the state using any of that for motive. And I don't think that anything that they would use would be derived from any of that testimony. In fact, I would think that the opposite would be the case. Okay, moving forward to what evidence might the state have that would show her involvement in the murder for hire? Now here, I'm not going to go through all the areas that suggest Wendy's involvement, either in the murder for hire or the conspiracy or something less, right? I focused on a few aspects that came up in Wendy's trial testimony. And again, I looked at all three trials, so it was quite a bit of work, and how they relate to this use and derivative use immunity issue. Okay, let's go to the first, Dan's schedule. Probably one of the strongest areas of evidence for the state, in my opinion, is Wendy's knowledge of Dan's schedule. You know, as his ex-wife, they had a parenting schedule under their marital settlement agreement. And under the marital settlement agreement, they were in the summer schedule, which was week on, week off, with a Wednesday overnight if the custodial parent was in town. Now, first, we saw the text that Wendy sent to Dan on July 6, less than 2 weeks before Dan's murder, while she was in South Florida with the kids for Harvey's big 70th birthday bash. Here's what it stated. Wendy, 10:47 a.m. Are you in Tallahassee, July 14 to 18? I just want to know if I can have the kiddos on the 16. Thanks. Dan, 10:49 a.m. Yes, you can. Now, you recall that Dan had custody the week of July 14 to 18. And actually, it technically started at 4:30 p.m. on Friday, July 11th. And remember that Friday, July 11th, Wendy said in her police interview that she couldn't bear to drop off the kids to Danny that afternoon because she had just spent 2 weeks with the kids and she was sad. She was already starting to miss them, so she had her parents drop them off at Dan's. That July 11th was a busy day for Donna, too. Remember, Donna sent Wendy that email confirming the Best Buy Geek Squad appointment that she made for Wendy on the morning of July 18 to fix TV. So with this text, assuming it was discovered in the initial investigation and not discovered after one of her trial testimonies, the state should be fine. Also, presumably, law enforcement was able to get that text off Dan's phone, too. And note also, the state never asked Wendy about this text. This came up in Sergeant Corbett's testimony. We also have the voicemail Dan left for Wendy at 9:02 a.m. on the day of his murder, where he indicates he's going to the gym from 9:15 to 10:30, but is available to talk with her about their older child's school situation afterwards. Now, with Wendy's testimony on this point, I don't really see an issue here. When she was questioned, she thought the text was something about Ben's school, and then Georgia actually showed her the transcript, which refreshed her recollection. So her testimony is not going to come in again under use immunity, but I don't see any issues in any event. Also on location, Wendy knew Dan would be leaving for New York on Saturday, the day after he was shot. Now here, I've only heard this in Wendy's trial testimony, which obviously the state will not be able to use. And Wendy has testified in all three trials that she knew Dan was leaving town for New York the day after the murder. She also denied knowing how the killers knew Dan was leaving town that day and denied relaying that information to anyone. However, I presume the state has other evidence to demonstrate Wendy's knowledge of Dan's travel schedule. And it's probably something like an email or text from Dan. So again, I don't see this as something that the state didn't investigate until after Wendy testified for the first time. Okay, planning. Now, besides knowing Dan's schedule, what else does the state have about Wendy's potential involvement in the planning of Dan's murder? Now, first, I thought about Jeff Lacasse, right? And his testimony about June 4th, when Wendy canceled their planned trip to California, which had been scheduled for the week of Dan's murder. Now, recall how Jeff testified that Wendy's reason for canceling the trip was that she had to be back by 4:30 p.m. on July 18th, the handover time for her visitation week. And he testified that even though he tried to make alternative plans, like a quick trip to St. Augustine, she was adamant about being in town for that week. Now, also on June 4th, Jeff testified how he saw Wendy that evening at her house, and she was a nervous wreck, sick to her stomach, and he had to go to the store to get her Pepto-Bismol. And recall also that June 4th through 5th was when Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera's first trip to Tally, which was that failed murder trip. We also have, from Jeff Lacasse, testimony from that last meeting after the yoga class on Monday, July 14th, when she was asking him if he was still planning on leaving town at 11 a.m. on Friday, July 18th, which was odd because she sent him that no contact email later that night. Was that a possible setup? Now, as far as Wendy's testimony is concerned, the only overlap I found related to that trip that Jeff wound up taking on Friday, July 18th, and it was in Katie's retrial, and Chris DeCoste asked her about that trip, and Wendy testified that she knew Jeff was leaving at some point that week, but she didn't remember when or at what time. So I don't see any derivative use immunity issues with Jeffrey Lacasse's statements. Now, as we already discussed in the motive section, Jeff provided three separate police interviews, with the first being within days of Dan's murder. So on that basis, I think the state should not have an issue proving that the evidence relating to Jeff is derived from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's compelled testimony. Okay, driving by the crime scene. Now, the state has independent evidence regarding Wendy's travels, allegedly, to the crime scene, including cell phone records, cell tower data, cell tower dump analysis, all from Sergeant Corbett. We also have the testimony from Officer Brannon, who was responsible for maintaining the integrity of the crime scene that day. And you'll recall he testified that he saw a minivan matching the description of Wendy's approach the crime scene and then stop and then quick made a turnaround. Wendy's trial testimony on this traveling to the crime scene has been a bit varying. In 2019, she denied turning on Trescott from Centerville Road. She said she saw some sort of tape or obstruction and she didn't turn. Now, in 2022, she testified that she did turn off Centerville Road onto Trescott. And then when she saw some tape and it looked like the road was blocked off, she turned around. Now, in 2023, she said she went to turn on Trescott, but saw had been blocked off by some tape, so she made a K-turn and continued down Centerville Road. Now again, none of Wendy's trial testimony can be used because it's protected by use immunity. But I think it's fairly clear that if she's charged, the state's evidence on Wendy's travels from her rented home to the ABC Liquor are all from legitimate sources, wholly independent from Wendy's testimony. So in conclusion, Although the fact that Wendy has used and derivative use immunity for her testimony in all three of those trials, I do not necessarily see this as a reason the state would not charge her for some crime. Now, of course, the Castigar issue makes this a bit more challenging for the state, and it's likely the defense is going to move for a Castigar hearing and require the state to prove that the evidence it proposes to use is derived from a legitimate source wholly independent from Wendy's compelled testimony. But as we discussed today, in my opinion, I think a number of those areas the state has that wholly independent evidence in order to defeat a challenge under Castigar. Now, of course, if the state were to charge Wendy, we don't know what those charges would be. You know, would they pursue the same charges that they brought against Charlie and succeeded and have now brought against their mother, Donna? Or will they pursue something lesser than murder or conspiracy to commit murder? We'll have to wait and see. But I want to thank you for joining me today. And if you haven't already, I'd really appreciate if you would consider subscribing and definitely liking the video. It really does help the algorithm and helps me grow the channel. I'm working on some content for a new case I'm going to be covering, and I'm also circling back to some of the other cases I've already covering. So I hope to see you in my next one.